Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, April 23rd, 2024, we're delighted to host a litigation update on Ream versus the United States Department of Treasury, which poses the question, is home distilling commerce? My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we'll keep our introduction of our guest today brief, but if you'd like to know more about either of our speakers, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Andrew Grossman, who is a partner at Baker & Hostetler, LLP. Mr. Grossman also serves as a senior legal fellow at the Buckeye Institute and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. He has been a frequent legal commentator on radio and television, having appeared on Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, CNBC, NPR and its affiliates, CBN and elsewhere. His legal commentary has also appeared in dozens of magazines and newspapers, including The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, The Washington Post, The Washington Times, and many others. Mr. Grossman has testified before the House and Senate Judiciary Committees and frequently advises members of Congress on complex legal and public policy issues. I'll leave it to him to introduce our other guest. A last note, and then I'll get off your screens. If you have questions throughout the program, please submit them by the question and answer feature so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Grossman, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Thank you to the Federal Society for hosting this program, and thank you to all of those attending. I'm pleased this afternoon to introduce Robert Ault. Robert Ault will be discussing the case Ream versus United States Department of the Treasury. Robert is the president of the Buckeye Institute, an Ohio-based think tank with a national footprint that is active in legal and economic affairs and public policy across issues across the country. Prior to joining the Buckeye Institute, Robert was a director in the Heritage Foundation Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, serving under former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese. Robert speaks frequently across the country. Many of you have probably heard or read his remarks regarding legal issues and particularly federalism issues. It's an area in which he has a great and deep expertise. And so that's why I'm so pleased to be speaking with him today. I should say at the outset that I am Robert's co-counsel on the case that we'll be discussing today, but was also asked to serve as moderator for this program. So I'll be in the unusual for me position of being the one asking questions as opposed to being the one struggling to answer them. So with that, thank you, Robert, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. And always an honor being interviewed by co-counsel.
So to begin with, why don't you tell us a little bit about what this case is about? I understand it's been filed recently. It's gotten a little bit of media attention. And it's gotten a lot of attention for the arguments that it makes regarding governmental power. But also, I think the subject matter is very interesting too. So what is this really all about?
Well, I think this case boils down to three of my favorite things: whiskey, freedom, and Ohio. And as we talk about it today, you'll see how those themes repeat throughout it. Whiskey, this goes to the question of whether or not it's permissible to distill whiskey at home for your own personal consumption, the freedom to do so. And Ohio, as I'll explain here in a couple of ways, Ohio features not just as the situs of our plaintiff and the case, but also the site of one of the major precedents in Supreme Court history with regard to governmental authority, and also the birthplace of prohibition. So Ohio actually features prominently throughout the story of this case. But let me take a step back and tell you a little bit about our plaintiff, if I can, John Ream. And John is, you know, his background is actually as an aerospace engineer. And, you know, so he has a very precise mind when it comes to, you know, sort of developing, you know, sort of processes and the like. And so a number of years ago, his then fiance, now wife, bought him a home brewing kit. And he began experimenting with this, as many people do, in his garage, and he became quite adept at it. And people, you know, his wife and others commented, you know, sort of how good the beer was that he developed. It was very, you know, he was able to create, you know, again, applying that engineering mind to it, he was able to create very subtle beers. And so at some point along the way, he decided to, you know, make the entrepreneurial move. He hung out his own shingle. He started Trek Brewing Company here in Newark, Ohio, and began his own craft brewery where he makes, you know, some very fine beer. Now, you know, much in the way that he, you know, that he engaged previously in the hobby of brewing, he would be interested in trying his hand at distilling. He has an interest in American whiskeys, bourbon and rye in particular. And, you know, given his sort of very precise nature, he would like to try his hand at home distillation for his and his wife's own personal consumption, not for sale. There's just one problem. And that is, you know, if you want to go home tonight and try your hand at home brewing, post reforms that were made, oddly enough, in the Carter administration, perfectly lawful to do so. If you want to go home tonight and engage in making homemade wine, I would highly advise against it on the grounds of taste, but you are permitted to do so. If you go home tonight and distill even a single ounce of whiskey, it is a felony. Even if you jump through regulatory hurdles to become a distiller, home distilling is prohibited, subject to substantial prison terms and fines. And so, you know, quite frankly, Mr. Reams' desire to try this as a hobby for his own personal consumption was snuffed out before he would even have the opportunity to do so. Yet there are many other people, it should be pointed out, who get, you know, who end up running afoul of this statute, or I should say, may not even recognize that they're breaking the law. You know, I'm guessing that there are people on this call who may have at some point or another tried their hand at home distilling, or have a relative, it always seems to be an uncle or a cousin who, you know, makes their own homemade distillation. But, you know, Even de minimis amounts is prohibited under federal law.
Well, that's very interesting. So there's this prohibition on home distilling, but I mean, people can distill in other places, just not in the home. But then in the home, they can, you know, undertake home brewing, as you said, home winemaking, as ill-advised as that might be. What is the government trying to achieve by singling out home distilling? Is it some kind of is it like a health or safety measure? What's the point of this?
There's no indication that this is a health and safety regulation. And indeed, you know, one of the things I would argue, insofar as this is a federal statute, health and safety regulations are traditionally the province of state governments. States have plenary police powers with regard to regulating health, safety, you know, and historically morals. You know, but even to the extent that the federal government, you know, could have a putative interest, they haven't stated an interest in that. To the extent that that were a concern, the states are more than capable of regulating in this space for health and safety. And indeed, many do. Many have their own rigorous regulations. And post the 21st Amendment, you know, states were particularly given, I think, pretty wide latitude with regard to how it is they regulated the sale of alcoholic beverages within their states. But that doesn't seem to be what's at issue. You know, if you take a look back when this statute arose in federal law, it seems to have been motivated probably, it, you know, kind of arose on the road down from the temperance movement to the prohibition movement, perhaps an early example of federal prohibition. You know, thus going back to my statement, it's oddly, I'm coming to you today from Columbus, Ohio, The suburb of Columbus is Westerville, Ohio, which has a plaque in the town square announcing that this was the birthplace of Prohibition, Westerville. It's always pleasant to have to, you know, there, across the street, there's a place where you can get a nice alcoholic beverage and look out at the plaque. But indeed, so it seems to have been motivated in some sense by that. You know, it's far from health and safety. It's part of the tax code, but it's not a tax. Well, I'm sure we'll get into that a bit later. But the idea that this is either for the purpose of health and safety or necessary in some sense to maintain health and safety just is not borne out.
What struck me about this particular prohibition is that it seems a little bit unusual. When you think about the federal government's powers, it's very difficult to come up with instances where the government is regulating non-commercial activity that takes place in a person's home. As you said, that sort of thing has always really been the province of the states. The only one I can think of is the one that was at issue a little bit more than a decade ago. Oh, gosh, I guess it was actually 2 decades ago at this point, in the Supreme Court in Raich. And that was, of course, the prohibition regarding marijuana. But is it your sense? I mean, are there a lot of other laws like this where the federal government claims some type of constitutional authority to reach into the home and to deal with activities that non-commercial activities taking place in the home?
Well, let's take a step back. I mean, obviously you have the Raich case, but I do think it's worth sort of taking a look at the development of the Commerce Clause, because you began with the question about non-commercial activity. And this really, I think to understand this at all, you need to understand the development of the Commerce Clause. Of course, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution grants to Congress the authority to regulate commerce between the states, as well as between the United States and foreign nations. And of course, the purpose here was to facilitate commerce between the states. It was not meant, at least as original, under the original language, to be a broad font of regulatory authority, in the nature of police powers. The early debates with regard to the scope of the Commerce Clause, tended to raise questions about whether or not the authority under the Commerce Clause included merely the ability to regulate the transportation of goods across state lines, or the potential prohibitions or regulations thereon, or whether or not it went to regulations with regard to manufacture, production, agriculture, et cetera, things in the production, on the production side of things. And so these tended to be the nature of the court's debates until the New Deal. And, there we have the case of Wickard against Filburn. And again, Ohio jumps prominently into our storyline. Roscoe Filburn was a farmer just outside of Dayton, Ohio. He grew a number of crops, including winter wheat. And under the Agricultural Adjustment Act, passed during the Great Depression, the government capped the amount of wheat or crops that farmers could grow, put maximum quotas on how much could be grown. Farmer Filburn exceeded his cap by several acres and was assessed a substantial fine by the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture. Filburn went ahead and appealed his case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And his argument fundamentally was this: look, the excess wheat that I grew never entered into interstate commerce. Indeed, it never entered into commerce at all. It stayed on my farm. I used the so-called excess wheat to feed my farm animals and to feed my family. To which, just sort of loosely speaking here, the court said all that may be true, but applying something, akin to the Kantian categorical imperative of constitutional law, if everyone did this, if we went ahead and applied a theory of aggregation to the underlying commodity, and because it is a commercial commodity, that could impact the overall market for wheat. If everyone who was a farmer grew and used this, otherwise he might have to grow less wheat and sell less wheat because he would have to keep some for himself, or he might have to buy wheat on the open market, but that this could somehow impact the price. But once you had sort of this aggregation theory with regard to the Commerce Clause, applying it under a substantially affects doctrine using the necessary and proper clause as well, it was kind of Katie bar the door. The question really became what Congress couldn't do with regard to regulating local activity, things that looked to be entirely local or homegrown in the case of Farmer Filburn's wheat, somehow became nationally regulable in nature. And this, so much so that I think for many years, it became almost the applied doctrine that there was no limit under the Commerce Clause to what it is that Congress could regulate. And you began to see some rolling back of this back in the 90s with the Lopez case. The Lopez case, of course, was the Gun-Free School Zones Act. And there, Angel Lopez, the interesting fact in this case is that Angel Lopez had actually transported a gun across state lines for the purposes of selling it. That's an often disputed or not recognized feature of the case. Notwithstanding that, he actually brought a facial challenge to the Gun-Free School Zones Act saying, look, carrying a gun in a school zone may be many things, but it's not commerce. You're not engaging in a commercial activity by virtue of carrying a gun in a school zone. And so that is not regulable by Congress. The government attempted to use, sort of a very attenuated chain of causation approach in terms of defending it, suggesting that in fact carrying a gun in a school zone, kind of taking aggregation on an attenuated basis to the nth degree, carrying guns in school zones increases violence in school zones, decreases scores, by the students in those school zones. Those schools perform poorly, then the states perform poorly, then the next thing the communists win, essentially. The Supreme Court under Rehnquist essentially said, look, this was too attenuated a chain of causation and this was not commercial activity, and found that there were some outer boundaries with regard to Commerce Clause authority. This trend continued in the Morrison case, in which the court struck down the tort claim provision of the Violence Against Women Act, again, looking at the fact that these potential tort claims may be many things, but they didn't constitute, the acts involved did not involve commercial activity regulable by Congress. I do think in both of those cases, you see a common thread, which is to say, in many cases, the federal criminal provisions do tend to rely upon the Commerce Clause with regard to regulating activity, even in the absence of any particular commercial transaction occurring. So this trend continued until Raich. Now, and Raich, of course, involved the production and possession of a Schedule I controlled substance, in this case marijuana, as was permitted under California law, and the question was whether or not that was regulable under the Interstate Commerce Clause. The court in that case essentially, applied Wickard to a black market, but I think there's some particular key distinctions at issue between Raich and what we're talking about here. In Raich, the regulation of marijuana was part of the Controlled Substances Act, and there Congress had promulgated a comprehensive system of regulation that covered both production and distribution and all phases in between, with a singular desired effect, which was to eradicate the trade in certain controlled substances, including marijuana. In this case, you know, with regard to distilling, you have nothing of the sort. You have what is in fact a legal substance that Congress has not sought to eradicate the trade in, where you have, you know, this sort of vestige of a prior era in which they have an existing flat prohibition on home distillation under a penalty of felony conviction.
You know, I've often wondered, you know, if Congress has the power under the Commerce Clause to regulate something like home distilling, because that might affect, under the aggregation doctrine, and because there might be a national trade in alcohol, why couldn't it regulate, say, require the licensure of frying pans? Because, of course, there's a national trade in food and combustibles and so forth, or ovens. Or, you know, practically anything that one has in the house. I mean, even beds. I mean, beds could be subject to federal licensure because, well, when you sleep at home, you're not giving money to a hotel.
One of the problems, I think, is, you know, under the aggregation theory, there's nary an activity that couldn't be aggregated in some way where you couldn't find some economic effect. You know, if I go home and tinker with my car because, you know, that's my hobby in the driveway, and, you know, presumably I'm depriving the auto mechanic or the dealer of, you know, the economic benefits that they would have if I took it in to be repaired by them. As luck would have it, the local garage is perfectly safe. In my case, they'll continue to get my money. But, you know, there are any number of hobbies that people do, including, you know, you could, you know, looking at Wickard, if you have a home garden where you grow, you know, organic heirloom tomatoes, you know, presumably, you know, again, those are heirloom tomatoes that you are not buying on the market. And so, you know, there is hardly an activity that you could look at where I don't think where there's any reasonable limiting principle under aggregation that would prohibit federal regulation.
And I guess that leads to the question, you know, after Raich, it just seems like there's, you know, we're kind of back in that period prior to the Federalism Revolution. I think people forget the heady days of the 1990s following Lopez, where it really seemed like just about anything was possible. In the lower courts, in the appeals courts, you had cases considering, say, the viability under the Commerce Clause of the Endangered Species Act, of the Hobbs Act, which is a federal criminal statute regulating prescribing certain types of extortion. There was just case after case after case where the courts questioned and in some cases ruled against all manner of exertions of federal power, and kind of started on, it seemed like the Supreme Court had kind of laid the groundwork towards a gradual reassessment of federal power, and reassessment of the role of the federal government vis-a-vis the states and vis-a-vis the people. And Raich kind of strangled the Federalism Revolution in its grip. So what, you know, what is left of that after Raich?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, one of the things I think that's worth remembering is the court, you know, the court did not abandon, you know, the doctrine post-Raich entirely. And I would point particularly to NFIB versus Sebelius. And you know, there, it, you know, it may seem cool comfort given the ultimate outcome of the case, you know, upholding the individual mandate with regard to insurance, based upon an alternative theory under the taxing power. But I, you know, I think it is worth remembering. I, you know, at the time, you know, just, you know, taking a stroll down memory lane, I actually did a number of debates for the Federalist Society at law schools across the country on the whether or not the individual mandate was permissible under the Commerce Clause. And, you know, almost 2-to-1 constitutional law professors across the country just considered it to be a foregone conclusion that, well, of course, it was within the authority to force an individual who was not in the market for insurance to purchase a product, that was clearly within the authority under the Commerce Clause. And the Supreme Court did, in fact, reject that argument. Notwithstanding the fact that Raich was a step backwards, it was not the last word on this particular topic. And, you know, I think that there is something a bit sui generis about it because of the comprehensive nature of the regulation, the regulatory scheme of the Controlled Substances Act, and, you know, what Justice Scalia particularly pointed to, the intention of Congress to forbid or eradicate the trade in those particular substances, you know, I think creates a different valence than when you're looking at regulation of localized non-commercial activities of products that would otherwise be lawful and indeed, you know, have been deemed by Congress to be lawful in other contexts. So in that sense, I think that there is an opportunity to pick up the cudgel of the federalism revolution of the 90s yet again. And I think that, you know, this particular statute really going to your question of what can't be regulated, this I think really is a fine example. I mean, here is something where there really is not a strong justification, at law or policy for the regulation in question. There are, adequate alternatives. If you have concerns about this, the states are fully capable of regulating under a proper federalism regime, and indeed they do. Congress seems to have very, precious little authority to regulate, this non-commercial localized activity, or certainly they should.
Well, I'm glad you brought up NFIB versus Sibelius, and I do intend to ask you about the taxing power. But before we turn to that, I just wanted to kind of, follow the thread regarding the Commerce Clause power. Let's say that you're right. Let's say that you prevail in this case. And that would necessarily mean that a court determines that the Commerce Clause power doesn't support this prohibition on home distilling. It's simply beyond the federal government's power to reach under that authority. What does that mean? What are the implications of that?
Well, I think there are a couple of potential outcomes and doctrinally as well as practically. On the one hand, this really, as we've discussed, I think if you look at the foundations of the modern administrative and regulatory state, this is one of the Commerce Clause is one of the central justifications for that. And so this would really address that, although in some sense a favorable decision would likely call into question a relatively small number of federal laws that represent some of the more aggressive applications of the Commerce Clause power. But I think really probably, given what we've been talking about, given what we talked about sort of in the 90s when it seemed that anything is possible, I think probably one of the key outcomes that you could see is a rekindling and rejuvenation of the, what we have deemed here the federalism revolution, or a more critical analysis of federal and or congressional authority under the Commerce Clause.
So, with that said, why isn't this, let me just, it's the joke that everybody had in the wake of NFIB versus Sibelius. Why isn't this prohibition a tax? I mean, maybe that's an unfair way of putting it, but, maybe the better question, or at least the more accurate question is just, why isn't this an exertion of the taxing power? I mean, after all, it's in the tax code. There is a tax on the distillation of distilled spirits, And so it would seem like this prohibition, it's part of that. It's tied up with that.
It is in the tax code, but simply being in the tax code doesn't make something a tax, nor does it, you know, suggest or guarantee that it would be permissible under the taxing power. And interestingly enough, you know, it's almost the opposite of a tax in this case. By prohibiting individuals from engaging in home distillation, you're actually prohibiting conduct that might otherwise be a taxable activity. So you're prohibiting, you know, you're in fact, rather than, you know, sort of, this isn't, you know, the sort of situation as in NFIB, where if you fail, if you fail to take a particular activity, we're going to subject you to a penalty, which we're now going to deem a tax. In this particular case, if you in fact engaged in the activity, you arguably might be engaging in taxable activity, but that in fact would be is what is prohibited and would subject you to a potential felony prosecution. So we are actually prohibiting you from engaging in taxable activity.
What about the people? I mean, I've heard of people, and I understand Mr. Ream is not one of them, but I've heard of people who do actually engage in home distilling. It's illegal. It's a felony. Federal law says you can't do it, but they do it anyway. I assume what they just don't report that.
I would think that is a fair assumption. and well, as I said earlier, you know, there are, I think, you know, interestingly enough, as we've brought this case, you know, you do in reading the literature and you know, sort of just having conversations, you do realize, you know, in addition to the, you know, sort of the made for, you know, sort of reality TV moonshining stories, you do hear stories of individuals who engage in some form of distillation who simply don't know. So, I mean, some of the non-reporting might arise from individuals who are simply unaware of the fact that even de minimis home distillation for personal consumption, not for sale, is in fact prohibited activity.
Well, so having gone through the issues, let me ask you, where does the case stand now and kind of what's the outlook going forward?
So we filed the lawsuit here in the Southern District of Ohio, a complaint against the Treasury relatively recently, I believe the end of January. The government just filed their motion to dismiss the Justice Department on behalf of Treasury, and there the arguments they made were precisely the sorts of arguments that you would expect. We will then be filing our response here, and the case will proceed. In terms of what's next, I mean, you know, this is a case I think where, quite frankly, you know, I think everyone would anticipate in this case that the district court will not be the last stop. I think, you know, it's fair to say, I think whichever side prevails will certainly appeal to the Sixth Circuit. And, you know, I think it's highly likely that whoever prevails there, the opposing party will go ahead and file an appeal from there. So stay tuned, because I think that there will be much more to come.
Well, with all that said, let me ask what is my last question before we turn to viewer questions. And I should say to viewers, there is a Q&A function where you can input written questions. If you have written questions, please put them in and we will get to them in just a moment. There are already several in the queue. But before we turn to viewer questions, I wanted to ask something that I think is very pertinent. What is your tipple?
That is a fine question. So, I have an old friend who chided me endlessly because he was a drinker of bourbon, he did so because this was American whiskey, and he disagreed with my choice in Scotch. So I am much more, in terms of whiskey, I am much more of a Scotch drinker. We can get, you know, sort of more specific. My taste tends towards Islay, in terms of the region, the island there. And I'm a particular fan of Bruichladdich scotches. And we can drill down even more from there, but I tend to like the heavily peated Scotch. But I feel like inquiring minds want to know, Mr. Grossman, what's your tipple?
Practically any distillation from Buffalo Trace, it will go down pretty easy in my book. So with that vital question answered, why don't we turn to some of the viewer questions? What does Ohio law have to say about home distilling? And maybe let me broaden that a little bit. I get the sense that probably different states take a different approach, different approaches. Is that right?
Absolutely. There are some states that do prohibit home distilling. Ohio is not one of those. Ohio does not prohibit home distilling. And in fact, there is pending legislation which would make it clear that home distilling is lawful and set down, you know, sort of more specific language with regard to that. But there is no standing prohibition with regard to home distilling under Ohio law.
And the different states, I mean, I guess the issue that we're talking, you know, that you've been talking about, with respect to the federal prohibition on home distilling, that doesn't really apply to the states, does it?
The issue, it certainly in terms of the Commerce Clause authority, obviously not. I mean, as we discussed, traditionally states have plenary police powers. They have greater authority with regard to regulating health, safety, morals. In addition, under the 21st Amendment, they have broader regulatory authority with regard to alcohol regulations. They are not, generally speaking, governments of limited enumerated powers under the Constitution. Rather, they have the reserve police powers, and so they would have the authority. These states would have the authority to engage in the kinds of regulations that we're talking about.
Thank you. So another viewer question. This is by from an anonymous attendee, whom I assume probably has a still in his living room. He asks, or she asks, perhaps, how often are home distillers charged with the felony?
I hazard to say precisely, but in looking and, you know, sort of in doing background and bringing the case, it certainly does happen. We have seen prosecutions with regard to even having certain of the still materials, we've seen prosecutions related to that. And certainly, I mean, when you tend to see it more, obviously, is when someone has done something to stick their head out, you know, which is to say, you know, they engage in some sort of home distilling and sell the product and thereby, you know, raise the attention of the regulatory authorities, but it still is very much a prosecuted offense.
And my recollection is that the Treasury Department has issued public guidance stating that this is unlawful, that it's subject to criminal penalties, and yes, they will come after you. Is that right?
Yes, and that guidance I was specifically, if I recall correctly, as well, related to the home distilling, lest there be any, you know, much, I think, for the reasons that we talked about. I think that there are those who don't, you know, this is not, you know, to go back to, you know, sort of for those of you who can remember your law school days and the early days of criminal law, you know, if you want to talk about your malum prohibitum and your malum in se offenses, you know, this is definitely in the category of malum prohibitum. This is not something that people would generally intuit is a legal violation. And so, you know, by virtue of that, I think it's more likely that you would have individuals who could inadvertently end up violating the law without realizing it or not realize sort of the full, you know, the full scope of it. So in this case, Treasury attempted to make it, you know, perfectly clear in this guidance that yes, indeed, you know, this criminal offense would apply to home distillers, even for personal consumption.
All right. We have another viewer question, and this is kind of an interesting one. It's a little bit off the beaten path. The viewer observes that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was upheld in the Heart of Atlanta case based on the Commerce Clause, the impact on commerce of discriminating in public accommodations. And so the question is, what impact would this litigation and maybe broader litigation regarding Congress's Commerce Clause powers have with respect to public accommodations and discrimination? And the viewer also adds, alternatively, I mean, would the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and perhaps the Privileges or Immunities Clause reach that be available for Congress to reach that sort of conduct? That's practically a law school course in and of itself.
Yeah, no, there's a lot to unpack there. With regard to what potential impact this would have, you know, the interesting thing is I'd have to look back at Heart of Atlanta and some of the related cases, but I don't think that they really relied on the aggregation theory and or substantial effects doctrine with regard to application of the Civil Rights Act to public accommodations. You can correct. I'll yield to you, Andrew, if I'm misremembering, but I don't recall that.
That might have been the instrumentalities instead, because yes. I think the idea was, you know, these are places that are involved in travel and so forth.
And so, you know, if you look back to Lopez, for instance, they talk about sort of, you know, the three categories of activities that are that the court has upheld regulations on in the Commerce Clause context. And so going to this, you know, the third prong, you know, which is what we're looking at, is sort of aggregation and substantial effects doctrine through necessary and proper. That's a different category than, you know, the channels of interstate commerce or the instrumentalities of interstate commerce, you know, some other categories that had also been, you know, within the realm of regulation. So it's not clear to me that this would necessarily. And part of that actually goes back doctrinally, to some of the common carrier doctrine, you know, dating back to jolly old England, and the idea, you know, some of the doctrine here arose from the idea that, you know, the inns that were on the king's highway were required by virtue of the license to take all comers. And so some of that actually infuses this doctrine as well with regard to instrumentalities of interstate commerce, you know, and anti-discrimination principles. That's kind of a separate thing. But, I think that was sort of a subtext as well to some of those cases. But yes, I think because of the fact that it's a different category, I think it's worth, I mean, you know, if you want to sort of think about what the potential implications are here, to take a look at Justice Thomas's concurring opinion in Lopez. I think there he talks about sort of what the substantial effects and aggregation theory has done to the Interstate Commerce Clause and the doctrine therein. You know, essentially he, you know, one of the arguments he makes, which I think, you know, is particularly helpful for students sort of trying to think about this is, you know, if you take sort of what the court has done under the substantial effects and interstate substantial effects and aggregation principles, and look then at the other enumerated powers under Article 1, Section 8, the powers to establish post roads, et cetera, to coin money. You know, many of these things you would look at and say, why is it if one believes in a rule against surplusage and thinks that, in fact, you know, we have to give each clause within the Constitution its due meaning? Why is it that the framers wasted their time with regard to enumerating all these various and sundry powers? It would seem that, you know, all or most of these powers would be subsumed under the Commerce Clause, under the aggregation and substantial effects doctrine through necessary and proper. But all that is to say, going back to that, I think it's a different category of regulation under the Commerce Clause.
And that's before even getting to the other prong of the question, which was, maybe this is all just beside the point because there's the enforcement section of the 14th Amendment. And, you know, even under the restrictions of cases like City of Burney, presumably Congress could reach that sort of invidious discrimination in private accommodations. Anyway, that's at least an idle thought. We have one last viewer question. If anybody else has a question, please add it to the Q&A queue. The question is there a 21st Amendment issue in this case? Let me broaden that and just, how does the 21st Amendment relate to all of this?
In terms of that, I'd say, first of all, you know, it probably does insofar as, you know, I think some of the background narrative that I talked about before, I think that the regulation probably, you know, arose in as a precursor to federal prohibition. And in some sense, it's vestigial. It is a vestigial organ that still has enforcement authority, if that makes sense, which is to say, it's, you know, this is not something that we don't know, you know, that doesn't actually perform any function. In this particular case, you know, it certainly is enforced, but the, you know, sort of the, some of the reasoning that what seems to have been the reasoning behind it, you know, the rising temperance and prohibition movements, you know, obviously were superseded by the 21st Amendment. And, you know, in some sense, I think the gloss there too is that the 21st Amendment, you know, granted, you know, greater authority to the states with regard to regulation. And so it makes even less sense in some sense that the federal government is persisting in a prohibition with regard to home distilling after the repeal of prohibition more generally and the granting of greater authority to the states. But I'd be curious of my co-counsel's thoughts on that as well.
I think you got it exactly right. You know, if you look at it from a 10,000 foot level, the 21st Amendment, to my mind, simply confirms that this is something that really is the proper province of the states. You know, to regulate the possession and use of a substance as a substance, and I don't think it necessarily adds anything to this particular challenge, but it certainly is an interesting and perhaps important part of the context. And with that said, I think we are out of questions. So let me again thank our viewers today. Let me thank the Federal Society. And of course, let me thank Mr. Robert Ault for all of his interesting insights and discussions of the Ream case. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll echo those thanks. I appreciate you both joining us today and carving out this section of your afternoons. Thank you also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, this webinar can adjourn.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.